This thing we call the economy, it's kind of a mystery. It goes up, it goes down. When the economy improves, people suffer, but people suffer when it goes down too. New technologies create jobs, but destroy old ones. The economy is really, like so many things in life, all about unintended consequences and ripple effects. This is Marketplace Weekend. I'm Molly Wood, in for Lizzie O'Leary. And this week on the show, we're looking at some of those effects. What a sudden influx of money does to a town, the good and the bad. How technology that could make trucking way safer and more efficient could also put millions of people out of work. And how a 20-year-old law designed to get people back to work kept a lot of them from getting the educations that would have gotten them better jobs. Unintended consequences and economic mysteries, all ahead. As we like to do, we're starting the week off with our segment Long and Short. That's when we make some bets on or against things in the news, but we do it using the language of finance. We're long on the things we like. We're betting against the stuff we're short on, just like they do it on Wall Street. This week, we have Marketplace's Andy Euler and LA Times Deputy Business Editor Dan Berkey. They're both here with me in our LA Bureau. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Let's jump in with you, Dan. What are you long on this week?
I am long on the American worker finally getting a pay raise.
Hope springs eternal.
Yes. It's been a long time for a lot of folks, but I am looking at some data that shows that wages actually are up a bit. The Atlanta Fed has a wage tracker. It's up 3.4% in the most recent month, July, and over the last 9 months, 3%. Now, that doesn't sound great, but I think American workers are finally starting to see some movement on this. Some big companies, especially at the low end of the scale, are, you know, boosting pay, Chase, Walmart. And of course, a big reason is that they're trying to catch up to some of the minimum wage laws,
right,
here in LA included.
And it might work.
It might work.
Is this something we can project out into? I mean, can we sit on this? Can we think, okay, This is going to be something we can look forward to, you know, over the next 6 months, a year?
Well, you know, if you're following the Fed's recent attempts to figure out whether it can raise interest rates and the employment situation, I mean, the unemployment rate has been, you know, fairly low recently. Pay growth is actually much better for people who are switching jobs. Mm-hmm. So you're seeing a little more movement. You know, people were not leaving jobs for a long time. People leaving jobs is a really good sign because it means, you know, they're getting a raise, they're, you know, motivated to move on. So if you're looking at the employment data, you're thinking, okay, there's a lot of pressure building up here, and yeah, this should, you know, this should have some legs. It should, you know, go out another year or so.
All right, Andy, what about you? What are you feeling positive about this week?
Positive is so funny. I'm ready to get called un-American, I think. I am long on American medalists paying taxes when they get back on their medals. There have been a couple of bills. There's a bill that passed the Senate, and there's one that I guess is going to get introduced in the House that would eliminate that tax. And we've all kind of read the articles and the headlines that, you know, Michael Phelps has to pay $55,000 when he gets back to the United States, mm-hmm, on the great achievements that he had.
Right. They have to pay taxes on winnings, and then there is also a victory tax that
applies to the
value of the medal and or any other winnings.
When you win a medal, you get paid a certain amount. So you, mm-hmm, get $25,000 if you win a gold. I think it's $15,000 if you win a silver, and then $5,000 for a bronze. But you pay, that's essentially your income. I think of it, though, as something that, you know, it's your job, right? We don't subsidize Olympians for, you know, being Olympians. Mm-hmm. And so when you get back to the States, you pay on your earnings, right?
So you think they should have to pay on their earnings,
sure,
but you also think they should have to pay this victory tax, this sort of, what I assume is also the tax you might have to pay if you win the lottery, that kind of thing?
Yeah,
it's cool, exactly, with that. I just want to get you on record.
Yeah, I'm totally cool with that.
You know what? I'm needling you, but from the reason that Michael Phelps has to pay $55,000 is because he's worth $55 million.
Yeah, yeah,
I mean, it's a
right.
It is comparable to your actual income and your sponsorship.
Right.
So
right,
for
yeah,
much poorer athletes, turns out a bronze medal is only worth about $4.
Yeah. Right.
It's not going to be a huge tax, and they can deduct it. So
right.
Well, I'm not with you.
But at the same time, too, one thing that I feel like we in the media need to be doing is not talking about Simone Biles and not talking about Michael Phelps and the different tax, you know, burdens that they're going to have. you're right. Let's talk about, you know, the person who got a bronze in archery, you know, or something like that. Let's talk about, sure, I'm fine with eliminating, you know, that sort of thing. But don't, you know, if you're going to try to tell me that these folks shouldn't be paying taxes, don't tell me about Michael Phelps. I see him on Subway commercials all the time.
We'll do the research and find out what the archery winners have to pay, and then and hopefully it's close to zero.
Right.
All right, Dan, what are you short on?
Well, maybe I'll be called un-American on this. I'm short on any of us seeing mass market, fully autonomous cars with us as the driver or non-driver in the next 5 years.
Really?
Yes.
And but what about Ford?
And what about Uber this week?
Right, Uber this week, of course. Yeah.
Well, here's the thing. I don't think what we heard from Ford and what we're hearing from Uber is about replacing you and I behind the wheel. I get it. If I have a Tesla and I get out on the highway, I can, you know, use autopilot and it'll kind of drive the car for me. But for me, fully autonomous means I'm at a concert and, you know, it's half hour till the end and my car is sitting in my driveway somewhere and I call the car and say, hey, come pick me up. I've had a couple drinks. And the car comes and picks me up and I fall asleep in the back seat and get delivered back home. That's not happening in the next 5 years. What is happening with Uber and with Ford is it's basically replacing jobs. It's taking people who are driving Uber and driving trucks, and it's, you know, putting a robot in their place. For most people who are buying cars and trucks, and let's not forget that the F-150, the Ford F-150 is the top-selling vehicle in America still, those people are not going to have a robot car in the next 5 years.
Right. So you're short on it as a mainstream application.
There's a lot of hype. Right. And I guess I'm kind of short on, you know, the delivering of that hype.
We talk about these cars all the time, but we don't talk about where these cars are going to drive, because the interaction of an autonomous vehicle with a person who's driving a car, that seems like the difficulty, right? Aren't we going to have to build highways for autonomous vehicles?
Well, if you talk to Elon Musk, he would say no. The whole point of autopilot is that it is dealing with the reality on the road now.
Yeah, in the short term, the infrastructure question is essentially solved by what's called geofencing, which is using that mapping technology to create software-based boundaries that the cars operate within.
Right.
And Ford has that technology now to some extent. So there's some infrastructure that can be accomplished with either wireless connectivity or software. But now I'm geeking out and I'm going to move on to what you, Andy, are short on this week.
I feel like such a naysayer this week, but I'm short on expensive chocolate and kind of artisanal.
At long last, sir. Yeah.
So you hate Olympic medalists and chocolate.
That's exactly right.
Okay.
I have to come out and tell you, too, that we have a chocolate club here at Marketplace. And we have a lot of really interesting chocolates in there. But Nestle had earnings this week and talked about how they're shifting what they're doing to kind of organic and more expensive chocolates because that's what consumers are more interested in. That's what millennials really want.
Do I sense the word artisanal?
I know you're working so hard not to say it.
Yeah, right. It's just one of those things where
you're not buying it though.
I'm not, because they also sell a ton of Kit Kats. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's where they make most of their money right now anyway.
But if I can take the other side of this.
Of course.
The price point on the artisanal chocolates is astounding. You will pay a lot of money for that, you know, 8-sample box of chocolate. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you can buy by the ton, you know, at Target or whatever in a bag. So I'm just thinking perhaps that's where the money is in terms of, you know, people actually, you know, paying higher prices per ounce or whatever.
Also, well, if I'm going to take the other side, it would be to say that there are reports of a looming global chocolate shortage, which would mean that expensive chocolate is the only chocolate we have.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and also you're right too, Dan, that, you know, if that's what people are buying.
Some people are buying.
Sure. I'm just kind of.
But not you.
No.
Not you.
No, I just I just want a Butterfinger or whatever.
Come on.
Perfect.
That's right.
Dan Burkey of the Los Angeles Times and Andy Uhler of Marketplace. Thanks so much, you guys.
Thank you.
Thank you, Molly. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. As we try to unravel the mysteries of the economy, we often look to economic indicators, GDP, unemployment, consumer spending, and the like. But the economy is relative. It's personal. It feels different to everyone, no matter what the numbers say. And that's why we've been collecting stories from people all over the country about what the economy feels like to them. We call it My Economy. And today we hear from one low-wage worker about how she makes ends meet.
My name is Tammy Schultz. I'm 46 years old, and I work at the University of Tennessee here in Knoxville, Tennessee. I do like what I do. I clean the offices. I get the trash. I dust. I clean off the table, buff up a floor or something. I clean the elevators, sweep the steps, shampoo some carpet, clean the railings off, and I bring home anywhere from $500 to $600 every 2 weeks. I have to juggle my bills around. A lot of things go undone that, I mean, I just have to prioritize. Like maintenance on my car right now. It's overdue for 2 months, and right now I just don't have the money. I have to pay the bills first. I have little for food. I don't go out. I don't do anything. Things are getting higher and higher, and the cost of living is getting higher and higher. Just for someone to be able to make ends meet and have a family, you know, they need to be paid more money. Right now I make $10.55 an hour. Possibly a good range of being paid to me would be anywhere from like $16 an hour to $22 an hour. At that point, I think I could pay my bills, not live lavishly, but, you know, at least live with my head above water and not have to worry about who am I going to pay this month, you know, is the bills going to be paid on time, or are they not?
There's more Marketplace Weekend just ahead. You heard us talk about autonomous cars earlier in the show, what impact they might have in the near and long term on the economy and on jobs. Well, now we're turning to autonomous trucks. In a recent article for Vox, writer David Roberts explains how almost 2 million trucking jobs could be at risk once this fast-moving technology catches up to the truck driving industry. These are good jobs, too, solidly middle-class jobs. No one's sure exactly when this change might happen or what the change will look like, but best guess, it's going to be big. Hey, David.
Hey there.
You know, we've been hearing, obviously, a lot about self-driving car technology this week. How far along is the truck autonomous technology comparatively?
Well, the NHTSA, the National Highway Transportation Safety Administration.
Yes, nailed it.
It has
we call it NHTSA.
Yeah, thank you. NHTSA has a scale of autonomy from 1 to 5. And right now, cars and trucks both are up to 3, mm-hmm. which is you can occasionally let go. Like it will take over on, you know, on some of the easier straightaways, highways, mostly interstate stuff. Like it'll maintain a safe distance from the car in front of you and the car behind you. It'll keep you in your lane. It can turn in some limited ways. So there's sort of it's kind of a limited partial autonomy that still requires a human being to be there and be ready to take over. Yeah. So that's level 3. Level 4 is where you get to real autonomy, i.e. You don't need a driver at all anymore. And so the how you make that transition from 3 to 4 is the, you know, the $6 million question. Nobody's quite sure exactly when that will happen or how it will happen.
So let's talk about some of the other issues that it raises, like liability. When it comes to insuring a self-driving truck, where does that liability lie?
Well, the short answer to that is no one knows. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons that no one's quite sure when full autonomy is going to arrive is less about the technology, because in a lot of ways, the technology is much farther along, I would say, than the social piece or the legal piece. You know, we're going to have a whole new set of rules and practices for this. And among that is, who's responsible for the decisions the truck makes if the driver is not making that decision? Is it the programmer of the software? Is it the owner of the trunk company? Is it that poor truck driver on the hook regardless? And no one's quite sure how that's going to work. I mean, my guess is that autonomy will bring such a decline in accidents and problems that the savings, that the insurance piece will sort itself out. It will be so much cheaper that it won't be a deal breaker. But we don't have a clue about a lot of how it's going to play out, and the technology is sort of forcing these questions on us much faster than we're prepared to deal with them.
Well, and one question that I know can feel a little bit overblown but is very real is about security and the cybersecurity of these vehicles and how hackable they are. I mean, do you think that these long-haul trucking companies are really prepared to have sort of chief information officers who are focused on, you know, their network security?
No. No. Again, no one's prepared. It's a theme here. You know, this is a problem for autonomous vehicles, but we're moving to an era where pretty much everything is going to be connected and automated more than it is now. And that's not just vehicles, it's buildings, it's cities, it's infrastructure, you name it. So this question of cyber security is a very deep and legitimate question. Mm-hmm. And obviously you can't have every truck company developing its own software cybersecurity solution, or you can, but I think that will turn out to be a horrible, you know, a fiasco. Yeah. So there's going to, again, there's going to be legal standards, legal guidelines. There's going to have to be some sort of interoperability type of standards, so everybody's working with the same type of software. None of that stuff is ready.
Yeah. And then let's go back to that human cost. You compare this transition to the displacement of coal mining workers and talk about how this is, you know, one of the last jobs in the U.S. that doesn't require a college education but still pays close to middle class wages. Can we talk about that impact for a little bit and how significant that's going to be?
Well, the comparison I use in the piece is the coal mining industry has lost about 50,000 jobs over the last 5 years. And that is considered a crisis. It's considered something that presidential candidates are forced to address, that there's a need for some sort of national solution to it. Well, 50,000 compared to 1.8 million directly employed truck drivers and many million more supporting them. So, I mean, the point I was trying to make in the piece is however you feel about how far along the technology is, whether it's 2 years away or 5 years away, even 10 years is a pretty small amount of time to lose 1.8 million jobs that are distributed very evenly across all 50 states. And like I say, is one of the last bastions for high school educated, working class people to get a job that actually pays decently well. So what are we going to do about 1.8 million unemployed people in 2 to 5 years? Mm-hmm. No one has a clue.
David Roberts, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. This week, we asked you to tell us how money has changed your community. Was it for better or was it for worse? Well, it turns out, in keeping with our theme about the mysteries of the economy, the answer isn't always obvious. Andrea Popovich is 40. She's living in Portland, Oregon, but she's from a town in California called Julian.
It is a small tourist town, basically. Growing up there, my fond memories are of the apple season and the constant production of apple pie, which is kind of the town's hallmark. And so I just have this fond memory of it as a place that I thought would always keep growing in the way that two of its neighboring towns have continued to grow, but it's actually shrinking. Hmm. The apple growers, a friend of mine told me recently, had a lot of thin years there, but are finding some opportunity with the resurgence of hard cider industry. This is a very interesting story. I asked my friend what's doing well there, and she says the summer camps do well. It's whatever is good for temporary use. She says the town still gets inundated with like 1,000 people at a time when there's a snowfall, but it doesn't. There's not a sustained community there.
Well, and I would imagine that then along comes the drought, and it's just like a 1-2 punch, right? If it's an industry really based around apple growing.
Absolutely. So there's a couple of contributing factors, too. It's kind of like the perfect storm, unfortunately. There was that cedar fire in 2003, and then there's this infestation of an oak borer beetle. And so the tree loss is a big part of why the people have stopped coming there. There's the economy. My friend's family moved there because her dad worked for AT&T in the microwave tower there, and that was automated. And so, you know, that's kind of the equivalent of a plant closing there. Mm-hmm. And then in terms of culture, people like me, like I left for college at the age of 17 and culturally didn't feel drawn back there. So there's kind of like these three things that make it a place where people still want to come visit a few weekends a year, but with the devastation of the forest, it doesn't stay in the year-round hiking economy that it used to and camping economy that it used to.
Andrea Popovich, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Jonas Koffler is 42. He lives in the Clarksville neighborhood of Austin, Texas. He says the money pouring in has done more harm than good for that city.
Over the past few years, you know, I think if you walk around the city, you notice a lot of real estate signs, which is a good thing because people are obviously flocking to the city and folks are cashing in and moving up and so forth. But what I've also noticed is that, you know, a lot of people are leaving town. And so I've talked to a number of friends who've left because it's just gotten too expensive here. So I think there are some real affordability issues. I think Austin is also going through some incredible growing pains. And I think we're starting to really impact this idea of the keep it weird. And it's becoming much more of a monochromatic experience outside of festivals.
What is your neighborhood like?
My neighborhood is an old neighborhood. It's Old West Austin, and it's a community with tremendous character, historically an African-American community, and actually a freedman's community. Hmm. So former slaves moved to Clarksville and made it their home in the 1920s, and we've lost a lot of the character of that community, but there still is sort of the vestige in an old Baptist church and a few families who still live in the area, but for the most part, it's much more of a white complexion these days.
Hmm. Do you see any positives?
The positives are, I mean, look, my wife and I were very fortunate to get in 2009 and buy a property here. You know, that's the positive for us in a kind of a very self-serving way. The negative is that you are extracting or removing access for the people who brought character to Austin to begin with, the artists and the thinkers, the irreverent rebels, if you will. So if you are excluding affordability, it makes it very hard. But I think there are more negatives than positives, Molly, is the short answer.
Got it. Thank you so much, Jonas.
You're welcome.
Then there's Malcolm Dior. He's 32. He lives in Brooklyn, New York, and he says his neighborhood has changed dramatically over the years. Some changes are good and some not so much.
Money has changed my neighborhood and community in so many different ways, both good and bad. After the hipsters, am I offended by using the term hipsters?
No, I was going to ask if you're a hipster.
After the hipsters moved into the neighborhood, I feel like we lost diversity. The mood is very ice cold. Neighbors are less friendly. The rent obviously has increased from $1,000 to $1,500 to $2,500, and it continues to go up. And local small businesses are closing down overnight. It's just, you know, it's really unpredictable.
Hmm. And then it sounds like you mentioned to us that Airbnb has had a big influence in your neighborhood. Can you talk about that?
Yes. Technology as a whole is also a major issue for some parts of my community as well, because, of course, apps like Airbnb, renters, property managers, and landlords seem to prefer short-term rentals opposed to the traditional 1 or 2 year lease agreement. And I experienced that firsthand because there's lots of blocks that I walk by. And, you know, sometimes I might be looking for an apartment to upgrade and get a bigger, you know, more space. And I inquire about these apartments. apartments, and it's interesting that the answer is usually the apartment is or the property is not on the market. But I opened my app with Airbnb, and it's listed there on Airbnb. So I feel cheated in a way. But then again, I am a member of Airbnb, so I want to be careful how I speak about them, you know?
Of course. And so what do you think your future is in the neighborhood? Do you want to stay, or are you thinking about leaving?
Well, I definitely want to stay because the change, I see more good in the changes than bad. And of course, I want to be a part of the changes. That's good. You know, if a neighborhood is growing, I want to be a part of that growth. But another part of me is kind of worried because I'm trying to stay afloat, and I don't know how much longer I'll be able to because of the increased rent and the constant changes.
Mm-hmm. Malcolm, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Next week, we're keeping the conversation going. How has money changed your neighborhood? Let us know by visiting marketplace.org or chat with us on Marketplace's Facebook page. Just search for Marketplace Business News or call us 1-800-648-5114. Let's talk about one more neighborhood. It's actually my neighborhood, or at least my town, Oakland, California. And it's a pretty textbook example of the effects of gentrification. Susie Cagle is a journalist. She wrote about Oakland's changes for Curbed.com. In her piece, she profiles a specific house. It's at 2523 Martin Luther King Jr. Way on the west side of town. And like most houses in the area, it's a flip. Susie's here to tell us more. Hey, Susie.
Hi.
So let's talk a little bit about this house. You wrote about this one particular property as kind of this microcosm of gentrification in Oakland. Let's go back in time then to 2008. What was happening to properties like the one you profiled on Martin Luther King Way?
So in 2008, people were losing their homes all over America, but especially in Oakland and other poor communities, especially communities of color. And the neighborhood, especially around 2523 Martin Luther King Jr. Way, was particularly hit by these foreclosures. And while a lot of people were losing their homes that they had invested in, these were also great investment opportunities for others. And that's what happened with 2523 and many other homes. They were cheap. They were bought up on the cheap, houses for $50,000, $100,000 that are now in this market almost $1 million.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so let's talk about then what happened to the neighborhood after these houses were foreclosed on, snatched up by investors. In some cases, it sounds like they're pretty corrupt investors.
Yeah, I mean, even the good investors did not really do right by the neighborhoods. They bought large swaths of neighborhoods, and even when they had the intention of fixing up these properties and renting them out, they took those properties out of contention for ownership. So they used to have these neighborhoods where people owned their homes and lived in their homes, and then they're foreclosed and they leave, and then you have this period of blight where there's no one there, and then someone comes in, buys that property at a foreclosure auction or directly from a owner who is underwater in their mortgage and wants to get out of it as easily as they can, and they fix up the property. Sometimes they fix the foundation and the roof, and sometimes they just put new paint on. And instead of choosing to sell those properties, for the most part, those properties were rented out. And ultimately what happened was that many people lost the opportunity to buy, and now they're renters.
Is there still a parallel, would you say, between that time period, 2008 to, say, 2010, 11, and now in terms of the kind of unequal distribution of mortgages? You talk a lot in your piece about how people of color were disproportionately locked out of mortgages. Is that the case as these neighborhoods gentrify now too?
That's what the numbers say. There was there's data from mortgages in 2013 that show that people of color in Oakland are disproportionately not getting those mortgages. It's just they're just not available to them at all compared to the early 2000s, you know, about 10 years ago when people of color were getting those mortgages and they were getting bad deals. They were targeted with bad deals. Now the problem is that people of color are not even getting an opportunity to buy a home, even if they have the credit and the money.
And we know that the kind of crash in 2008 was preceded by a run-up on prices. We have a huge run-up on prices now in the Bay Area. Are there any safeguards to prevent the kind of mass foreclosures from happening again?
I guess the safeguard is that we presume that the people who own houses here are now much more rich. I don't know if there's actually any real policy safeguard besides, you know, presuming that people aren't getting those subprime loans, that when they're getting a mortgage, there's an income check, and that there are more stringent safeguards on who's getting what kind of loan. But I think that you could say that this housing market, especially in Oakland, is still at great risk. It's just at a different kind of risk. Now it's people who maybe they have a really well-paying job right now, but who's to say what is going to happen to the technology industry in the coming years, and how many people will continue to have those jobs, and what happens if they don't have that job? Are they still able to pay that mortgage? And now these mortgages are huge. They're jumbo loans to pay for these million-dollar-plus homes. So housing researchers that I spoke with for the story and other reporting that I've done are nervous. They're not feeling like this won't necessarily happen again.
That's Susie Cagle, a journalist writing from Oakland. Thanks so much for your time, Susie.
Thanks so much.
There's more Marketplace Weekend just ahead. This is Marketplace Weekend. I'm Molly Wood. This Monday, August 21st, will be exactly 20 years since Congress overhauled the welfare system. That overhaul prioritized work over education and training, and as a result, made it a lot harder for people on welfare to go to college. That's because in order to qualify for cash assistance, people have to do some kind of work. And 1 year of school can count as work, but that's it. So how did Work First work out? Marketplace's Amy Scott has the story of what happened to two women after welfare reform.
In 1995, Ilana Gamble was living in San Jose, California, divorced with three kids, when she found out her ex-husband was about to get out of prison. So she loaded her family onto a train and moved 3,000 miles across the country to rural La Plata, Maryland.
I had an aunt that owned an apartment building, so I was kind of like, got a place to live. So it worked out. It worked out really well that we came here.
Gamble has reddish blonde hair and clear green eyes. You can tell she has Irish roots. And now at 53, she can say it all worked out. But back then, she knew her savings wouldn't last long with three little kids. So while she looked for jobs,
I had to go seek help.
Help came in the form of welfare. She got about $400 a month in cash assistance, plus food stamps and a small housing stipend. Eventually, she picked up some weekend shifts bartending at her aunt's restaurant, and they got by.
Barely, yeah. It wasn't unheard of for me to have to write my mom a check when it came time for taxes, because I would have been borrowing throughout the year, sometimes with my mom and my aunt. You know, that's pretty much how I made ends meet.
Gamble didn't like working in a bar, and she wanted a better life, so she signed up for business classes at Charles County Community College, and she did well.
In fact, it's crazy because I was a terrible student in high school. I mean, I'm talking terrible with a capital T.
But in college, at age 33, she was getting straight A's and was on her way to an associate's degree.
I knew I could get the degree, and I probably would have went on then to get a bachelor's because it was so easy, you know, unfortunately. Didn't work out that way.
Partway through her third semester in early 1997, she got a letter from the welfare office. The law had just changed, and to qualify for cash assistance, she would need to spend more time every week in a sanctioned work activity. Gamble says she was told her school hours would not count.
Well, I couldn't go to school and work and go to their work program. There was just no way out of it, so one had to go, and I had to obviously leave school to continue working to support my three children.
She finished the semester and dropped out. It's hard to say how many students like Ilana Gamble left college, Before welfare reform, close to 700,000 people on welfare applied for federal student aid. And just a few years later, that number had dropped by almost half.
The caveat here is there's lots of other things changing at the same time when welfare reform hits.
Leslie Turner is an economist at the University of Maryland. She says in the late 90s, the economy was booming and a tax credit for low-income workers had grown.
All of these things may also serve to push women both out of college and off cash assistance because jobs are plentiful.
Still, she says, there's no question welfare reform made it much harder to go to college while receiving benefits. But there were exceptions. And a few hours' drive from where Ilana Gamble's college education ended, a different story played out in Baltimore.
Where your student profile, where your test scores?
Oh, I bought that one.
Okay, we need that.
That's Patricia Edwards, giving an orientation to new students taking developmental or remedial classes at Baltimore City Community College. These classes can be pretty discouraging, so she runs a support program to help students stick with it.
First of all, I'm honored to serve you in this capacity, okay? Because I started out at Baltimore City Community College in developmental education, okay? So we know what's possible, right?
Edwards is tall with a shaved head. She's wearing long feather earrings. She's 49 now and works as coordinator for academic services at the college. But in the fall of 1998, she was a single mom raising four sons on welfare. By then, the law had changed, but Baltimore City Community College was starting a two-year pilot program. It allowed about 200 students receiving cash welfare to count their school time as work, exactly what Ilana Gamble in La Plata hadn't been able to do. That made it possible for Edwards to enroll full-time and support her boys. They supported her, too.
I used to get them to read my books to me while I was, like, ironing or washing or cooking or whatever I might have been doing. They would read the book. They were kind of good at that.
The pilot program was extended, and Edwards ultimately earned two associate's degrees in public policy and general studies. She then went on to get a bachelor's degree and got off welfare. Now she's working on a master's and making a good living helping struggling students succeed.
Which is why I love my job so much, because now I can give back what was so freely given to me.
In her office on campus, the walls are decorated with cards and letters from students she's helped. In a framed photo, she's surrounded by four young men, smiling in tuxedos, her grown sons at a family wedding.
I like to have inviting things in my office for people to ask about, rather than a bunch of degrees. Because I feel like degrees are intimidating for people who have done a lot of things to mess it up. And it makes you hesitant to ask for the help.
It would be great to say that things worked out so well for everyone in Patricia's group. The University of Maryland School of Social Work studied the pilot program at BCCC. Research Director Letitia Passarella says compared to a similar group of welfare recipients that didn't go to college, those in the pilot were not significantly more likely to be employed or to stay off welfare 2 years later. But they did earn higher wages.
What would have been much more useful is to do some more longer-term follow-up, because much of the research has indicated that the benefits of an education are actually delayed.
But Passarella also studies what happens to people in Maryland overall after they leave welfare, mostly without education and training. Most of them work, but in low-paying industries without benefits or opportunities to move up. In one analysis, only 9% of welfare leavers saw any growth in earnings 5 years later.
That's the important point, because it contradicts the idea that a client can go out and get a job, any job, and then they will experience earnings growth because they gain skills. It seems that that is pretty rare amongst clients who leave welfare.
And that brings us back to Ilana Gamble, who you'll remember dropped out of college after welfare reform. She eventually got a full-time job bartending and got off welfare. She's remarried and still lives in La Plata, and today manages a banquet facility for the Navy.
It's hard to do when there's sun in your eyes.
It's a government job with benefits, but she's making under $40,000 a year, less than she made bartending, and less than she'd make doing the same job with a college degree. She never went back to college, though she's thought about it.
I have many times, but it just never was feasible anymore. Just financially, I couldn't do it.
She's not bitter about what happened.
I mean, I get it. I totally get that they want to get people off welfare. And essentially it worked for me because it forced me off of it. But it forced me into a situation where I couldn't go very far.
And she wonders how far she could have gone with a college degree. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
You can hear more stories about what welfare looks like now with our Marketplace podcast, The Uncertain Hour. And one final note, as part of that series, we introduced you to a little-known album of Welfare to Work songs. And the person behind that music? Larry Townsend. He was head of the welfare office in Riverside County, which is a large suburban county east of Los Angeles. As part of a bunch of reforms in Riverside in the early 90s, Townsend used $2,000 in taxpayer money to record a CD called Work Makes the Difference.
It feels so good to have a job. Feels so good. I get respect in my neighborhood. Feels so good to have a job. Feels so good. Feels so good. I get respect in my neighborhood. Feels so good. Feels so good. I feel so good to have a job. So good to have a job.
Well, now you can listen to the entire album as part of our series. 10 songs, but just 13 minutes of jazz, hip-hop, reggae, and pop takes on welfare and work. Just download The Uncertain Hour wherever you get your podcasts. You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. We're going to end with a little break from pure economics and talk about politics. The 2016 election marches on, as you've probably noticed. Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton are battling for voters in televised addresses, in personal appearances in swing states, and of course, online. Social media was pretty novel in the 2008 election. It was more noticeable in 2012, but it is fully incorporated this year. Campaign staffers are tweeting speeches and polls. Candidates are hosting conversations on Facebook, and everybody is documenting everything on Instagram. Zeynep Tufekci, professor at the University of North Carolina, joins us to talk about social media and the campaigns. Zeynep, thanks for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
So I want to see how you would describe how candidates are using social media in this election cycle. I feel like we've seen them embrace memes, put policy there, a little bit of everything.
It has been fascinating, and the Clinton campaign has been using it fairly traditionally, to the degree you can say anything traditional about a medium that's basically a decade old. Mm-hmm. But she's been using it to sometimes respond and sometimes put out policy or comments. It's clearly the Trump campaign where things are a lot more interesting. For one thing, for example, I've been noticing how during the debates, other candidates during the Republican primary, all the other candidates' Twitter accounts were active during the debates. They clearly had things to say, or when they thought their candidate had something, you know, sort of tweetable, they tweeted it out, whereas Trump's was silent, which was fascinating because that indicates a personal control, which is unusual for a professional campaign, but it also gives his Twitter account a very personal voice. In fact, to the degree people have tried to reverse engineer which phone is used for tweets from Trump's own personal, either dictating or typing.
Really?
And which is professional, yes. And it's pretty clear. In fact, you can look at the metadata, and the iPhone tweets are overwhelmingly from his staff. And the Android tweets are from himself. And I hadn't noticed this because I wasn't looking at the metadata, but I was just sort of eyeballing which ones were his and which ones were staff. And I had created a list that I'd even highlighted which ones I thought were his. And then I went back to the metadata and saw that I had a almost 99% accuracy because his voice is so personal,
right,
and identifiable. What he's doing that's interesting with Twitter is that he's using it instead of polling. It's like this gut check. He puts out a message, and I think he looks at what resonates and what doesn't, because you can see themes that he picks up from Twitter come through in his rallies. And the same thing with his rallies. I was curious about him, so I attended one. And I saw how he would feel the crowd and respond to the crowd. So what you've got is a very narrowly focused campaign that is responding to social media and is responding to rally response and to some degree to media response and not really trying to broaden beyond that.
That sort of gets to the real heart of the question, which is how important is this? Because on the one hand, it seemed like a candidate could potentially win the presidency on the strength of social media. Now it feels like maybe that it's too narrow to the point of inaccuracy in terms of responding to mainstream needs.
Well, it's obviously both. For one thing, social media is where all the journalists are very active. It might not be representative of the general population, but the politically active people, the people who report on news, the journalists and people who follow news, they tend to be more active. Mm-hmm. So it might be a good place to try to test out your messaging. It might even be a good place to see what kind of reaction you would get. Of course, if you mistake that for either a general election base or if you sort of see something on Twitter and think, oh, this must be true, obviously that's not really going to work. Also, you see in Trump's campaign, you've seen him tweet again and again, retweet messages and memes that are coming from white supremacist Twitter accounts. So you can see that he's not either checking the source carefully, or he doesn't care that that's the kind of message he's amplifying. And hasn't seemed to have hurt him with a floor of 30-35% of the electorate. And that's just what he seems to be focused on going to the general election with, at as far as I can tell at the moment.
How much work do you think candidates need to do or will need to do sort of reconciling their Twitter personas with their public personas? You know, Trump is clearly speaking to followers. Anybody who is speaking on Twitter is speaking to people who have professed an interest. Is there a need to sort of make those two personas match?
It's harder to be different things to different people, not just because of social media, but because of the ubiquity of cameras. You might remember in the past there was this not very good tradition of candidates saying one thing in small meetings or behind closed doors and then going and saying something else publicly. Mm-hmm. And in the past decade, I've seen example again and again of a candidate being caught out by these divergences. Now, whether you know your tweeting is done personally or not is not as much of an issue, I think, because clearly there's going to be staff and there's going to be some vetting, although obviously Trump is an exception. In fact, people have taken to calling his Android phone where he personally tweets from the night phone because you can see him tweeting, you know, middle of the night and arguing with people, which is, you know, it's very personal.
Yeah.
We might not see a repeat of that. But on the other hand, no matter what you think of his views, it's pretty clear his base thinks this is who he is. And a lot of people, you know, find his views problematic. But if you put that aside for one second, the fact that he appears to have made that connection clearly helped him win the Republican primary against opponents that were much more polished and vetted. And that, I think, is an interesting lesson. It really doesn't mean, you know, you have to be a candidate picking fights with reporters at 3 a.m. from your phone. You know, that's not obviously not the model I'm advocating for here. But I think there's a lot more room through this kind of medium to be more consistent and more of who you are. Because if it's not the case, then it comes out one way or another. We have so much more scrutiny over candidates and their past and their statements. And I'm not sure we'll ever have a Trump again. But then again, I wouldn't have guessed this 2 years ago. So hard to know.
Very true. Zeynep Tufekci is from the University of North Carolina. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you for inviting me.
And And that's our show for this week. Next week, Lizzie is off on a reporting trip and David Lazarus will be here for you. We'll continue our exploration of how money has changed your neighborhood. If you have a story to share, please let us know. Visit marketplace.org, chat with us on Marketplace's Facebook page and search for Marketplace Business News, or call us 1-800-648-5114. Your voice may be featured on air. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Haley Hirschman, Eliza Mills, and Cerise Castle. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer. Charlton Thorpe is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Sitar Nieves is Marketplace's executive producer, and Deborah Clark is our vice president. I'm Molly Wood. Thanks for listening. This is APM.